Moses too much.
Aye, he would try,
Abigail says with a rueful twist of her mouth. Regardless, Hannah appears to be spoken for, and Dolly is still a bit young for courting. But if the circumstances were different on either count, yes, I would open the door for John Cowan, and I believe Ephraim would as well.
That's about how I reckon things, but I wanted to make sure, Abigail says.
Then as I turn to go, she reaches for her mug. Martha? Yes? I hand it back.
Dinna be surprised if Moses comes knocking a bit sooner than ye expect.
I set my quill on the desk and stretch my hand. It aches from cold and age, and the strain of small muscles put to work guiding a child into this world. Friday, December 11. Birth. David Sewell's son. Cloudy. At Mr. Sewell's. I was called to attend Grace Sewell yesterday evening. Her travail was mild, but she and her mother were intimidated and called Dr. Page, who gave my patient 50 drops of laudanum, which put her into such a stupor that her pains, which were regular and promising, became scant until she puked. Her pains returned, and she was delivered at the 7th hour of a son, her firstborn. I received 12 shillings as a reward, left her cleverly at 10, and walked across the river. Cyrus and young Ephraim have long since crawled into their beds on the second floor, and I can hear their snores rattling down the stairwell. The girls have also retreated to their room and whatever dreams the night might bring. Jonathan, as usual, is sleeping elsewhere. My brows pinch together in frustration at the thought of him, but I continue writing. Saturday, December 12. Clear and cold. James Wall was carried to Fort Western by an officer today. I hear a charge was given against him for failure to pay debts. I stretch my back, listening to the wind in the pines and the creak of the house as it settles around me. I can hear a coyote yipping in the pasture and an owl hooting near the barn. The fact of the matter is that I am lonely. And then I laugh. If anyone had told me 2 decades ago, when I was buried in small children and endless chores, that one day I would sit at my desk in a warm, quiet house while the snow fell outside and complain of loneliness, I would have slapped them. That future seemed as far away as Constantinople. I blow a long, cool breath over the new entry to set the ink, then put aside my quill. I would very much like to join the rest of the house in slumber, but I can already feel the creeping wakefulness that often assails me at night. This is a new affliction, something that began once I rounded the corner of 45. I never understood what a gift sleep was until it vanished. Whereas in all the decades before, I slept deep and heavy, soaking up every morsel of rest that was offered. I now skim the surface, fitful, easily woken, and unable to drift off again. On nights like this, no amount of physical exhaustion can induce my mind to shudder. So I read by candlelight instead. It is the only time I allow myself this indulgence. The joy of falling into another life, another world, is the one thing that mitigates the frustration of a sleepless night. I change into my nightgown, brush my hair, slip under the covers, and reach for the candle on the bedside table. I scoot it closer, then open Emmeline by Charlotte Turner Smith. Ephraim purchased the novel on his last trip to Boston. The cover is tattered. I am not the first owner, but the print is clear. And there are no missing pages, which is more than I can say for most of the novels I'm able to get my hands on. Within seconds, I am immersed in a make-believe world of English aristocracy. But it does not escape my attention that, had my own ancestors enjoyed such comfort, I would be living across the sea, and not here in the vast wilds of the New World. Ballard's Mill, Sunday, December 13. The house smells of dead animal, like hide and fat and wild game.
The acrid scent will last for several days, but there's no help for that. The deer tallow is pungent, but once it has been made into candles and cured, the scent will fade. I have added dried, crushed lavender and rosemary, along with their oils, to each of the four rendering pots that sit on my work table. In a week, the candles will simply smell like the forest, and the house will smell of home once more. "There," Dolly says, tying the last of the linen threads to the end of a slender, foot-long branch. 240. I inspect her work, then nod in approval. Dolly tied the wicks while I readied the hardening racks along the edge of the room. Each branch will hold 2 candles, and each rack will hold 48. Altogether, we should have enough candles to get through the winter, with extra for bartering. We spent all morning rendering the deer fat given to us by Amos Pollard, then straining it until the tallow was smooth and pale. Dolly and I both wear aprons to keep the oily spatters off our clothes, and scarves around our hair to keep it from falling in our eyes. Candle making is hard, sweaty work, and not a task meant to make a woman look pretty. It is, however, one of the necessary parts of running a household. We take our spots at the table and lower the first branches so that the wicks on either end drop into separate pots. The thick linen strings soak up the wax for a moment before we lift them out again. It takes a few seconds for the rendered fat to harden, and then we plunge them in again. We repeat the process, watching each candle grow in width with every immersion. Once they are an inch wide, we set the branches across a drying rack so that the candles dangle as they harden. The task will take several hours to complete, but neither of us minds. Rarely do we get an entire day together. It is one of those winter afternoons that is so bright the sun reflects off the snow and hurts my eyes if I look at it directly. I cannot help but worry about Ephraim working his way through the frozen marsh up north. His people are Welsh, but have lived in the colonies for 2 generations and have grown acclimated to these northeastern winters. He insists that he no longer feels the cold. I know that he's lying, but he says it anyway. It's the game we play, a dance of concern and denial. Hannah has been with Lucy, our oldest, married daughter, and her family on the other side of the river, near Fort Western, all week. Lucy had her 7th child, Hannah's namesake, earlier in the year, and was eager for both her help and her company. There are 11 years between them, but they have always had a special bond. And now that Hannah is nearing the age of marriage herself, I suspect there are questions she would rather ask her sister. This reality makes me a bit uneasy, however, given Lucy's casual attitude toward things of a carnal nature. Her first child was born a mere 5 months after her wedding. There are rules and rituals, of course, for young people and how they court. Usually it begins at one of the seasonal frolics. Just last month, May Kimball's family hosted one, and there will be another in January here at the mill. But still, young people always find ways to be together, away from watchful eyes. And any time my children are out of sight, I wonder what they might be up to. As for the boys, young Ephraim has joined his older brothers in cutting trees in the forest today, and none of them will be home until dinner. Only Dolly and I are here, and it is both restful and strange. It seems as though only yesterday I had a baby on each hip and 2 more wrapped around my ankles. I plunge the candles into the tallow, then pull them out again, watching the excess drip off and back into the pot. The rendered fat has cooled slightly and isn't as runny, making the process go faster. And I like the way the dried herbs speckle the tallow. But I keep an eye on the consistency, because if it gets much thicker, the pots will need to go back over the fire. We work in companionable silence until Dolly says, "I took stew and bread to Mistress Foster yesterday while you were out." "And is she well?" I ask. "No better," Dolly says. "No worse." Ever since Sally Pierce made her accusations, the Fosters' world has grown increasingly small. Many of those inclined to defend them now whisper behind their backs. They wonder. They gossip. Some neighbors avoid them altogether. Few in the Hook cared that Joshua Burgess was dead until their pastor was incriminated in his murder. And those who dismissed Rebecca's claim of being raped look at her askance now that she is pregnant. I am thinking about what I might do for Rebecca when Dolly points at something out the window. "Who is that?" she asks. It's a simple question, but there is a curiosity, a certain kind of light in her eyes, that I note before turning to the window. A man has driven his wagon up to the garden gate and dismounted. He is young and agile, of average height, and I recognize him immediately. That is Barnabas Lambert. I've never heard the name. He's an officer of the court from Vassalboro. Dolly finishes dipping her candles, sets the branch on the hardening rack, then moves to the window for a better look. She fists her hands on her hips and gives the man a curious stare, head cocked to the side, lips pursed. Why would an officer of the court come here?
An excellent question, I say. You keep working on the candles. I'll find out.
My tallow has gone thick, she says.
And I know she wants to come along. By the faint smile tugging at the edge of her mouth, I suspect that Dolly might find the young man attractive.
Then melt it again. I'll be back shortly. I keep my apron on and the scarf around my head when I go to greet Mr. Lambert. I pull the front door open before he has made it through the garden gate. He tips his hat.
Good morning, Mistress
Ballard.
Good morning, Mistress Ballard.
I know who you are, Mr. Lambert. He stops on the path, chin tilted to the side, an expression on his face that suggests he's trying to remember if we have met.
You do?
I saw you apprehend James Wall and the Hook yesterday. He takes off the wide-brimmed felt cap and whacks it against his leg twice, even though it isn't dusty.
Ah, then you won't be surprised to hear that I've come to arrest someone else.
I like James, and still think it unfair that a measly debt could land him in jail, so I can't keep the snide tone out of my voice when I reply, "Someone forget to pay their taxes? Or perhaps you're after a gossip." There, I've almost made him smile, but it doesn't quite reach the surface.
A bit more serious than that, I'm afraid. I'm here to arrest a man accused of rape.
You've come for Joseph North. He shakes his head, and a single curl flops onto his forehead and falls across his eye. It makes him look younger somehow, less serious. He shoves it away with the back of his hand.
No, I'm here for Joshua Burgess.
He doesn't know. How is that possible?
Well, Joshua Burgess doesn't live here, I hedge.
So I gathered, but now I'm known in town after what happened yesterday, and it's always best to have the element of surprise when coming to arrest a man. I halfway expect him to have fled anyway. I thought I'd stop and ask the neighbors first.
And you just happened upon us.
You are the first drive off the main road into town.
He hooks one thumb over his shoulder and points north.
At least coming from Vassalboro.
Well, I say, taking comfort in the coincidence, I know for a fact that Burgess hasn't fled.
But are you willing to tell me where he is?
I pull the corner of my bottom lip into my mouth, thinking, if you'll tell me something in exchange.
And what would that be?
Why you haven't come for Joseph North.
Ah, I see.
Barnabas scratches the back of his neck.
Direct orders from the court. I'm to let North come in on his own for the hearing.
And why does he get different treatment?
Because he's a judge. And a colonel.
James Wall was a captain, and you arrested him in front of 20 people. He nods once, but doesn't break eye contact.
There is a wide gap between captain and colonel, isn't there?
And a wide gap in favor, too, I'd say. You think that is fair?
What I think has nothing to do with it. I'm only an officer of the court. No one asks my opinion.
I just did.
He flashes a quick, bright smile.
I think that I've a single job, mistress, to apprehend the men I'm ordered to. And I'm the sort of man who does my job.
Yesterday, when he was scuffling with James, I hadn't gotten a good look at him. But I take Barnabas in now, curious about this man who has stepped into the scandal enfolding our town. He has sandy-colored hair and eyes that might be hazel, or perhaps brown. I can't tell from this distance. But there's something about his face and the way he moves that makes him appear unremarkable. It occurs to me that perhaps he does this on purpose, to seem non-threatening. He's young to be an officer of the court, and looking nondescript, especially to strangers, would be an advantage.
Your turn, he says. I've answered your questions.
You can find Joshua Burgess at Pollard's Tavern. He flicks a glance to the house behind me, then back, another smile quirking the corner of his mouth.
Seems to be a popular place amongst the criminal element in your town.
James isn't a criminal, I say. He's a friend, in fact. And there isn't a man in this town who wasn't shocked to hear that he's failed to pay a debt.
Abashed, Barnabas nods once. It's not an apology. He doesn't owe me one. But rather an acknowledgement that he's misjudged the man.
Go to the tavern. Ask for Amos Pollard. Tell him I sent you. He'll take you to Burgess.
I thank you for the help, he says, replacing his hat.
He tips it. Adds,
mistress,
then looks over my shoulder. Again, he offers that charming smile and tips his hat a second time.
Miss?
I turn to find Dolly leaning in the doorway, hand on her hip, scarf conspicuously missing from her hair. She watches Barnabas with an expression that I can only describe as proprietary.
Well, that's new.
Good day to you, Mr. Lambert. I say, walking to the garden gate to see him off. He unties the reins and climbs onto the wagon seat. Another tip of his hat, another glance over my shoulder, a smile that twitches at the corner of his mouth. And then he is gone, unaware of the gruesome discovery awaiting him at the tavern. Dolly comes down the walkway to my side.
Why didn't you tell him?
About Burgess?
Yes.
Because he'd have gone back to Vesselboro.
That's a bad thing?
If he goes home now, he'll never see the body. And if he never sees that body, he won't ask any questions about how Joshua Burgess came to be hanged, then thrown in the river. I look Dolly full in the face and see the vivid flash of understanding in her eyes. I want as many people asking questions as possible.
I think he will,
Dolly says, with a firm nod. She turns her gaze down the drive to where Barnabas and his wagon have already disappeared into the trees. He seems clever. It's a woman that does the choosing. I remember Ephraim's statement from a few days ago. Anyone who thinks differently is a fool. Tuesday, December 15. Clear and cold. I have been at home. Made 20 dozen candles. An officer went by here looking for Captain Burgess with a warrant for his arrest. Dr. Coleman's store. Tuesday, December 15. I am not the only woman who has come to Coleman's in hope of finding something today. There are two women at the counter waiting to be served, and three more at the back when I step in, wicker basket tucked in the crook of one arm. I pause just inside the doorway to shrug out of my riding cloak and shake the snow from my hair. The stack of pelts beside the counter hasn't grown any taller, but I don't like the bright, bushy red tail sticking out from the center. I'm scowling when I turn and come face to face with Sarah White. The young woman takes one look at my expression, bursts into tears, and tries to push her way past.
Wait,
I say, dropping my basket with a thump. I grab Sarah's arm.
What's wrong?
I should have known better. Come early or late, Mother said, but not while the ladies are out.
Ladies, a pejorative if I've ever heard one. I lead her to the side.
Tell me what happened.
Them, Sarah says, nodding to where three women huddle in the far corner, backs to the room.
Made it clear I wasn't welcome here.
It isn't their store. She sniffs and wipes two fat tears off each cheek with a cuff of her sleeve.
They sure act like it is.
If Sarah White had been born in another town, to different parents, she would have married early and well. Her face alone would have assured that, but her figure would have likely caused a duel. As it stands, she lives in the Hook, and her parents were ill-equipped to protect such a lovely girl. A dalliance with a member of the Boston militia last year has left her with a bastard daughter and a ruined reputation. Did you find what you need? I ask. She shakes her head.
Well, you'd best do it then. It isn't often you get out without the baby, and your mother won't like to see you come home empty-handed.
But let them answer to me, I say, nudging Sarah back into the shop. I grab my basket and move to the back where Coleman keeps the sewing supplies. The three women sift through bolts of fabric spread along a table. They whisper amongst themselves, laughing, and I listen as one of them speaks in a tone bubbling with glee.
Can you believe how brazen Sarah is, flouncing around without that baby?
I look through the slats in the shelf to find Clarissa Stone running her hand along a bolt of soft blue cotton. Her face is angled toward the companion on her right, mouth twisted into a vicious smile.
It's indecent, Rachel Blossom agrees.
Peggy Bridge chimes in then, unable to resist a bit of gossip and a disapproving tisk.
There are hours for her to shop. Her mother should have taught her.
Oh, her mother clearly didn't teach her anything, Clarissa says.
And I am opening my mouth to excoriate them all when she adds,
did you hear about Sam Dalwin?
I step back to make sure they don't see me.
What about him?
He and May were married in Henry Sewell's living room on Sunday. They went to housekeeping immediately. Her mother is furious. Clarissa receives exactly the response she intended.
Mmms and tisks and heads that shake in judgment.
Doesn't it seem odd? She asks. They only posted their notice of intent 6 weeks ago. Peggy, not one to be left out, adds,
I heard they made quite a public show of affection. My husband saw Sam kiss May right on the street.
This last word is said with such an air of scandal that she may as well have implied they ran naked through town after church. Clarissa nods, pronouncing her verdict with certainty.
May is pregnant.
The others gasp, but it's only for show, and she looks gratified when she adds,
why else would they marry so quickly?
It is an appalling display of hypocrisy, and I will not tolerate it a moment longer. I step out from behind the shelf, startling them. They spin around, horrified to find that their ugly conversation has been overheard, and by me no less. Varying expressions of shame, anger, and suspicion dart across their faces. Both Clarissa and Peggy are heavily pregnant. Clarissa to such a degree that it looks as though she might already be past due. I let my gaze linger over their swollen bellies. Let them grow uncomfortable beneath my gaze. Perhaps they married quickly because they are in love. Or because Sam nearly died a couple of weeks ago, and that certainly makes a man think there is no time to waste. I move closer, lower my voice. There is nothing wrong with a man wanting to share a bed with his wife right from the start. What is wrong, however, is gossiping about your neighbors in such a cruel way. And not just Sam Dalwin, a good man by anyone's standards, but Sarah White. That is rich, even for the likes of you three. As I recall, I add, twisting the knife,
You delivered your first child 4 months after your wedding, Peggy. It was 6 months for you, Rachel. I look to Clarissa Stone and shake my head. But you're the one who should be most ashamed of your pious outrage. It took a year and a bitter paternity suit before Paul would make an honest woman out of you. I don't have to remind them how I know this, how I attended each of them in childbirth, and that, in Clarissa's case, I received testimony as to the paternity of her child, which I later gave in court when she sued for maintenance. Not one of you has the right to speak, I say, and if you had a lick of integrity, you would go apologize to Sarah this instant. Only Rachel Blossom has the decency to blush. The others shift and glare before turning their noses to the ceiling and brushing past me. I am sorry, Rachel whispers as she turns her face to the floor and follows after them. But like her friends, she does not say a word to Sarah on her way out. I watch them go, imagining how they must be cursing me under their breath as they hustle back to their homes. They have left the bolts of fabric in disarray, so I fold and straighten them into neat rows on the table. A bolt of pale green silk catches my attention, and I pluck it from the pile, run my thumb along the nubby weave, check the price tag, put it back, pick it up again, back and forth 5 times, until I make up my mind and tuck it under one arm. I do need a new dress, after all. I look up to find Sarah White standing in front of me. Thank you, she says. You didn't have to defend me. I made my choices, but I'm glad you did nonetheless. It was the truth, and they needed to hear it. Sarah looks so sad as she's turning away that I reach for her hand. I want to ease her embarrassment, to reassure her that not everyone in the Hook considers her an outcast. Their opinion of you doesn't matter, Sarah. It isn't just them, Martha. It's everyone. It's hard to stare down an entire town, she says, then goes to pay for the items in her basket. I watch as Sarah leaves, her chin tucked against the collar of her dress to avoid the cold blast of wind. It pains me to think of her so alone and ostracized in this community. It will be harder for her to find a husband now that she's already born a child. But she is not without hope, and I resolve to help find her a man who will love her as she is. I turn back to the sewing supplies and ask, where are the needles? Behind you and to the left, second shelf from the bottom, green jar, Holman calls out from the front of the store. You heard that? I'm mostly blind, Mistress Ballard, but my ears work fine. Sure enough, the needles are right where he said, and I take a packet from the jar, then sort through another beside it for buttons, before bringing everything to the front. I set the basket at my feet and lean against the counter. I'm afraid to ask just how well your ears were working a few moments ago. You weren't taking great pains to keep your voice down, and they deserved it regardless. Perhaps, but it wasn't very kind of me. And what they were accusing Sam Darwin of, that was kind, he asks. Hardly, although it is human nature, I suppose. Hypocrisy? Well, yes, they feel better about themselves whenever anyone else is caught doing the same. But neither Sam nor May have been caught in anything, which is why I didn't hold my tongue. And I like you all the better for it, he says. Coleman turns back to his chessboard. Now, how can I help you this morning? I slide the packet of needles across the counter, along with a small pile of buttons and the silk. Will that be all? There are a dozen things that I would like to have. A new cast-iron kettle for the kitchen, a set of blue glass bottles for my workroom. But as I do each time I step through these doors, I remind myself of what I need. Nothing, unless you've heard where they took James Wall. I hear he's been confined to the jail yard at Fort Western until his debt has been paid. So he posted bond then? Coleman nods. Yesterday. Being confined to the jail yard and being in jail are two entirely different things. The latter is, as it sounds,
arrest and confinement for a set period of time. The former, however, is a loose arrangement in which those waiting trial, or those who have been arrested for unpaid debts, are able to post bail and then go about their work during the day within a set area, but must return to the jailhouse by dark. Sunrise to sunset, the bounds of their freedom include a distance of 1 mile on either side of the river, from Mill Brook to the bend in Water Street. In the rare instance when a home or business falls outside of that boundary, it is included as well. Coleman studies me for a moment, and I get the feeling he's deciding whether or not to tell me something else. There's a bit of food stuck between his teeth, and he picks at it with his tongue for a moment, then says, "That new doctor of yours has created quite a stir." "He's not mine," I protest. "Most folks seem to be glad he's here. Having another real doctor is a boon to this town, they say, and he's got money." At this he offers a crooked grin. "So, I don't hate him." "Money?" "Oh, aye. His young wife arrived on Friday, bought up half the store so she can set up house." He gives me a knowing look. "She is very pregnant. Only a few months left, I'd say."
"They're renting rooms?"
"No," he shakes his head. "A house across the river. They've leased the old McMaster place right near the Chandlery."
"Well, that explains a lot," I mutter.
"Be careful with him, Martha. He's made it plain that he doesn't care for you, thinks you're a meddler."
The feeling is mutual.
"Perhaps, but he's recruiting to his side, and that will hurt you in the end. What with the Burgess fiasco and Grace Sewell's delivery."
"You know about that?"
"He's made sure that everyone knows. Says that you insisted he give that girl a near lethal dose of laudanum. Adamantly opposed he was. But he deferred, given that you know the girl. Wanted to make nice with the local midwife after the dust-up in court. Him being a genial fellow and all."
"That foul little bastard, I did no such—"
Coleman sets his hand on mine. "I know, but that's what you're dealing with, and you ought to be aware." I groan and rest my elbows on the counter, drop my head to my hands. Damn that Burgess. If he wasn't already dead, I'd kill him myself for all the trouble he's caused. As I hear it, he's still causing trouble. When I look up, he's trying to wrestle a grin into submission. "Barnabas Lambert? Got quite a fright, he did, when Amos pulled back that tarp, demanded to know what happened. So Amos told him everything. And then that officer marched right to Henry Sewell's office and looked at the court records. From what I hear, he seems to agree with your assessment. I am beginning to like that boy."
"Well, he don't like you overmuch right now."
"He doesn't have to like me as long as he keeps asking the right questions."
"You might regret saying that one day," Coleman laughs. "That boy don't seem the sort to stop."
I place everything into my basket and hoist it over my arm. "Thank you for the goods and gossip."
"Always," he says,
and once more reaches out his old weathered hand and grabs mine.
"Be careful, Martha. Sentiment has turned against Rebecca Foster. It's turning against you as well."
Ballard's Mill, Thursday, December 17. Thursday, December 17. Birth. Mr. Stone's daughter. Clarissa Stone was delivered of a dead daughter at the 12th hour yesterday, the operation performed by Dr. Benjamin Page. The infant's limbs were much dislocated, as I am informed. The man knows not how to deliver a breech presentation. Hannah brought the news this afternoon. One day after scolding Clarissa Stone at Coleman's store, she went into labor. And instead of calling for me, as she should have, she called for Dr. Page. This is my fault, I'm certain of it. I know I was hard on her for shunning Sarah and gossiping about Sam, but this, it is too high a price to pay for her and for me. I set my pen down, close my eyes, weep. Ballard's Mill. Friday, December 18.
Ephraim is dead.
That is the nagging fear that has plagued me over the last 12 days, and I have to drive it from my mind so it does not take root and fester. I feel his absence as though it were a missing limb, some vital part of me gone, and often find myself looking to the lane watching for his return. I must leave for Vassalboro on Tuesday, with or without him. I would prefer with, of course, but am growing less certain by the hour that he will make it home in time. If he makes it home at all. No, I say aloud, taking that thought captive as well. In his absence, I keep myself busy. Cooking, cleaning, spinning flax, and weaving linen. I tend to the neighbors and my patients when they call, making tinctures and syrups in my workroom. I manage our small farm and assign work for my children. Cyrus runs the mill. Hannah and Dolly milk the cows. Jonathan tends the livestock. Young Ephraim oversees the chickens and tends to the horses. He has a soft voice and gentle hands, and I have never seen a horse startle or rear in his presence. Still, he's a bit young for the job, and I check on Brutus and Bucket once a day just to make sure all is well. I slide between the heavy barn doors, a bucket of slops in each hand. It is time to feed the pigs, but Jonathan is nowhere to be found, which means he slipped off again without telling anyone. The barn was built as a large square with a peaked roof and four separate quadrants on the inside, one each for the horses, cattle, goats, and pigs, with a cross-shaped walkway between the pens. It smells of old straw and fresh manure, of alfalfa, hay, and barley stacked in the upper loft. It smells of warm animals and wet sawdust. The horses whicker as I make my way between the stalls. Both dairy cows are pregnant, and they shift and low at the sound of my voice, while the bull stomps and snorts in his pen. He is restless, eager for another chance at the cows, but he's done his job for the year and will have to wait until breeding season in June. The calves, one male and one female, are bored and they nap, oblivious, as the goats bustle in their pen, bleating out their request for dinner. Hush, I say, it's not your turn. Jonathan will see to you later. I lift one bucket and then the other over the pig pen rail and dump the contents into the trough, wincing at the wet, vomitous sound. I don't stay to watch the fat pink animals root and snort their way through dinner. I've never been fond of messy eaters. I am almost at the barn door when I hear the thing I've spent weeks listening for, the heavy clop of horse hooves on frozen ground. Ephraim, I whisper, and run out the door, an empty bucket swinging from each hand. They bounce against my calves as I hurry down the path, careful not to slip on the hard-packed snow. My smile evaporates the moment I round the bend and reach the front yard. Joseph North has dismounted his bay mare and is tying his reins to the gatepost. His mongrel dog sits at his feet, looking at me as though I were a meal. He bares his teeth but doesn't growl. I drop the wooden buckets with a clatter and set my hands on my hips. What do you want?
I've come to see the results of Ephraim's survey. I stopped by the mill, but he wasn't in.
He may as well have said that he stopped by for tea or to bring payment on a late bill, but his eyes are pinched at the corners, calculating, and I know that he came to see if Ephraim has returned. That's because he isn't at the mill.
Where is he, then?
Out.
Where?
I have never met a man who enjoys giving his wife an account of his every movement, Colonel. Ephraim goes where he pleases and returns when he will. As to the where and when, you'll have to ask him yourself, because I certainly don't know. North takes in my disheveled appearance, the tatty work clothes, dirty hands, and the scarf tied around my hair.
I see that I have caught you in the middle of your work, he says.
Perhaps it is my imagination, my dislike for the man.
but I feel he emphasizes the word in a way that suggests only an unrefined woman would deign to perform physical labor. Do tell Ephraim that I'm looking for him. I hope he might leave then, but his departure is interrupted by Cyrus. My son rounds the bend in the path, coming from the barn, with a fishing rod over one shoulder and a string of blueback trout in his hand. As always, he is grinning, nearly bursting with good cheer. Yet if I had a knife in my hand at this very moment, I would joyfully drive it through North's throat for the look of disgust that flashes across his face as he watches my son approach. Cyrus Ballard is 33 years old, and he will never marry or have children of his own. He will never work away from the mill or go to sea, though it is his greatest desire. He will never explore the vast wilds of this untamed continent. Cyrus is 33 years old, and he is mute. He was robbed of speech at the age of 12, and the loss has marked his life in irreparable ways. There is no flaw in his intellect or physical ability. He is tall and strong and handsome. He can read and write, and can communicate with his hands when necessary. It is a form of speech we have adopted, motions instead of words. But outside of our family, he is often pitied, thought dim-witted. An illiterate population cares little for a man with beautiful handwriting, and without speech, he cannot make them understand.
Hello, Cyrus, North says.
He glances back and forth between us, then grins.
Has your father returned from his surveying trip?
Cyrus crosses his arms over his chest and glowers. He doesn't like North any more than the rest of us. After a moment, he moves to stand beside me, protective. Why don't you take the fish inside, I tell him. They'll want cleaning. He nods toward the string, where a cut runs down the belly of each fish to prove he's done it already.
There is some talk about you in the village, North says.
Cyrus's hazel eyes pinch in suspicion. He is unable to take the bait to ask what this talk might be.
Apparently, you got into a fight with Joshua Burgess the night he died. That is fascinating timing, don't you think?
What are you implying? I ask.
Only that your son thrashes a man in front of 50 people, and several hours later that man turns up dead. I find it curious. Perhaps that officer from the court will too. I hear he's been sniffing around.
Should that happen, you will no doubt refer him to your own judgment of accidental drowning.
A judgment made without benefit of all the facts,
Joseph North smiles.
I cannot help but wonder if you knew of the fight when you testified before me, Mistress Ballard.
I owe this man nothing. Not answers, not explanations, not respect. And I give him none of it as I stand there waiting for him to leave. But he isn't done.
I want to know what Rebecca Foster told you. If I am to defend myself, I must understand the charges.
The charges seem simple enough to me. A small muscle twitches along his jaw.
The details are vital to my defense.
Your defense is not my concern, Colonel. I am going to Vassalboro to testify on Rebecca's behalf, not yours.
I am judge of this county. By law, you cannot keep that information from me.
It is my duty before the law to give my testimony to the court. As you well know, you will hear it, along with everyone else, next week, before the judge in Vassalboro.
Perhaps.
He might as well have said if your husband is present, if your husband is still alive. If. But perception means a great deal to Joseph North, and he cannot break character in his role as the wrongfully accused. Perhaps. A more civilized, urbane, less threatening word. Still, there are oceans of meaning in those two syllables.
No need to be concerned, Colonel. I am confident the hearing will proceed as planned.
He strides back to his mare, gathers the reins. I watch him swing onto his horse, then turn her in a small circle.
You might consider all the ways your confidence is misplaced, he says.
As if on cue, Cicero growls. If I were you, I'd feed that thing before he bites someone.
No point feeding a dog when it can take its own dinner by the throat, he says,
then drives his boots into the mare's sides. Joseph North canters down the drive, mongrel dog at his heels. Friday, December 18. Cloudy and some snow. Colonel North was here. He examined me regarding what conversation Mrs. Foster had with me concerning his conduct toward her last August. I have been at home. Saturday, December 19. Clear part of the day. Today is 35 years since my marriage. Mr. Ballard has not returned from his surveying. I have been at home. Sunday, December 20. Killing chickens is a bloody, awful mess. The task usually falls to Ephraim or Jonathan, but both are gone. So today, Cyrus and I have undertaken the job of butchering, and we usher three ornery cocks to the yard. These are the last of our extra roosters from the spring. Mean things that torment us with beak and spur every time we go to collect the eggs. They are small and spindly, and I'm tired of them. It's no great sadness to see them put in the oven to roast. I hate the axe, I tell Cyrus. We should use revenge. He gives me a questioning glance. Your father's blade, down at the mill. That awful hooked thing, revenge. That's what we call it. Fetch it if you would. It takes him only a few moments to go there and back, but the blade is in his hand when he returns. We silently debate which of us will do the job. He points at me, holds his fist as though he's grasping something, and I agree because there is no good way out of this work. I'll face spurs or blade one way or the other. Better to be in control of the thing that cuts. Cyrus grabs the first bird. He holds it upside down for several moments, letting the blood rush to its head. When its eyes close and its wings stop flapping, I know the cock has fallen asleep. Cyrus holds its head in his other hand and secures his grip on the feet. I hate killing things, but I hate these roosters more, and this is the most humane way to dispatch them. So I cut the fowl's throat with a quick C-shaped motion, and it's done. Cyrus hangs the bird by its feet at the fence so that the blood will drain. It goes quickly enough after that, one after the other. Once we're done, he goes to clean the blade and put it back at the mill. I will have Hannah and Dolly dress and cook the birds once they're plucked. There's no clean way to finish the job, but it's better done outside than in the kitchen, where the feathers and blood will get everywhere. I scald the birds in hot water to loosen the feathers, and then I set up my stool and carving stump in the yard and get to work. Soon there is a pile of black and white feathers in the bucket at my feet. I have gutted the last rooster when once more the sound of horse hooves echoes down the lane. But there are two sets this time, and I do not even bother to get my hopes up. When I lift my head, I see that North is back, and he's brought his wife with him. Halfway down the drive, he holds out his hand and motions to Lydia.
Wait here, he tells her,
then kicks his mare into a trot. Lydia North does as she is told and pulls her small gray horse to a stop. She's covered in a green riding cloak, and all I can see is her pale face peeking out beneath the hood. She looks unwell, and her hands are tucked into a muff to stay warm. Damn it, I think, but go to meet North at the gate, hands sticky with blood.
Colonel?
He's dressed in riding clothes and packed for a journey, headed to Vassalboro early, no doubt. The cur is at his heels, eyeing me in that ravenous, predatory way.
Ephraim,
he asks, not bothering to dismount or offer a greeting. On his way. He snorts, unconvinced.
I would give you one piece of advice. When you stand before the judges,
North says, voice just low enough that his wife cannot hear, his arm sweeping wide to indicate the house, the barn, the mill.
Remember who I am. After all, your family depends a great deal upon my generosity.
Are you threatening me?
I am reminding you, he says, that as an agent of the Kennebec proprietors, it is my duty to confirm that you have met all the conditions required to obtain the deed on this property.
Don't worry. I remember exactly who you are, I say. Rebecca Foster told me. I have been so consumed with the chickens that I didn't realize how miserably cold it is out here. The sun has passed its zenith and is sliding toward the horizon, dragging the last of the day's meager heat with it. And a breeze has come in from the east, whipping shards of ice into the air. It stings my cheeks and makes my eyes water. Joseph North's voice is every bit as cold as the air when he replies,
Clearly, there is more than one idiot living in this house.
I gasp at the insult. I could scream with fury. But I'm not the one who makes the sudden screeching sound. It comes so quick and so loud that I jump, spin around, see nothing. But then there is a rush of air and the flapping of wings as an enormous bird dives toward us. It does a lazy circle around the house, swoops between me and North, then glides to the garden gate, gripping the wooden board so tightly that its talons gash open the weathered cedar. Cicero yips and growls, but he too sees those lethal talons and keeps his distance. North pulls his horse backward in alarm, but I feel only a wild rush of relief. Percy, I whisper. There are only three falconers in the territory of Maine, and only one in Hollowell. Ephraim is the only one who practices mounted falconry. So when I say the bird's name, Joseph North loses all bluster and turns his horse away. I thought you wanted to speak with my husband, I call after him. As you can see, he is home now.
It's getting late, North says, gravel in his throat. I've no time left to dither.
On horseback, at a brisk walk, it will take 4 hours to reach Vesselboro. There is no chance he and Lydia can make it before nightfall, which means they must find shelter along the way, or ride after dark. Pity, I say, loud enough that Lydia can hear. I am certain my husband would love to speak with you about your visits this week.
Cicero, come,
North snaps. He neither looks at me nor bids me farewell. The mongrel trots after him, skinny rump wagging with each step. North has met up with his wife, halfway to the tree line, when I see another horse and rider emerge. My heart soars for one brief second until I realize that it is not my husband. Moses Pollard is riding his father's favorite stud and wearing his Sunday best. He has a bouquet of bright red sumac berries in one hand and a silly grin on his face. Oh, good grief, I whisper. Percy tightens his grip on the garden gate, and I hear the scratch of talon against wood. The jesses dangle from his feet, all 12 inches swaying back and forth as he watches the young man approach. Moses has noticed the bird as well, and he pulls up 10 feet from the gate. His horse prances uneasily. Did you pass Ephraim on the drive? I ask.
No.
Moses dismounts, holding the bouquet awkwardly in one hand, as he gathers the reins in the other. He clears his throat, uncertain how to proceed now that he knows Hannah's father is not at home. It is obvious he is not prepared for this possibility. Percy, however, is growing impatient and squawks loudly, bobbing his head. He's hungry, I explain. For a moment, Moses's eyes grow round with alarm,
and I realize he's taken it to mean I might set the bird on him. Hannah, I call, then tighten my lips to stop from laughing when Moses pales. Oh, how faint grows the heart of man when he plucks it, still beating, from his chest and lays it at the foot of a woman. When my daughter appears in the doorway, I say, "You have company, and please send Cyrus out with one of those roosters. Percy is hungry." Hannah's cheeks bloom with happy color when she sees Moses. She smiles at him. He returns the gesture. And I know that all is lost. There will be a wedding within the year. "Is Father home?" she asks, looking at the bird. "I don't know, but I have to get Percy to his muse." Hannah ducks inside and returns a moment later with Cyrus, who is holding a plucked bird by the neck. He smiles and dangles it above the ground. There is a teasing glint in those hazel eyes that suggests he might lob the bird right at Moses just to see what happens. Hannah is his little sister, after all. He can't make it easy for her suitor. Under different circumstances, I might let him toy with Moses. "Toss it in front of the gate," I tell Cyrus, "before he comes at you." The chicken lands with a wet flop exactly where Cyrus intends. I back away when Percy launches off the gate and starts to savage his lunch right there on the path. "Moses, why don't you go inside with Cyrus and Hannah and have some tea? I'll get Percy put away in the mill and will join you shortly."
"Of course, Mistress Ballard," he says,
tying the reins and easing through the gate. He keeps a wide berth, careful not to watch the carnage, then follows the others into the house. He would come calling on an afternoon in which it is impossible to keep any sense of decorum. At least they will have a story to tell their children one day. Carefully, I ease to the side and wash the blood from my hands. I am not ashamed to admit that I wait too long to collect Percy. I am hoping Ephraim will come down the drive at any moment and relieve me of the duty. But he does not come, and there is no sound of hooves anywhere in the woods. It grows quieter and colder by the moment. "I'm going to speak with your master about this," I say, pulling the shawl off my shoulders. It isn't enough protection, I know that, but it's better than nothing. And I wrap it around my left forearm. Percy could crush my arm with one ferocious squeeze of those talons. He could rip through flesh and bone. But surely Ephraim's training isn't for naught. This is what I tell myself as I hold my breath, close my eyes, turn my face away, and extend my left forearm at a right angle from my side. No sooner does it come to a halt than a wall of air and beating wings hits my face. I ease the door to Percy's muse open with my foot. He did not, in fact, wound me. Most likely because I did exactly as I have seen Ephraim do 1,000 times. Once Percy was stable on my arm, I looped the fingers of my right hand between his legs, just above his talons, then lifted him off my arm. After that, it was only a matter of securing the jesses and walking, arm extended, down to the mill. Still no sign of Ephraim. Every minute that passes makes the stone in the pit of my stomach grow heavier. All the terrible fears I have kept at bay for the last 2 weeks crash against one another, growing louder and louder. But I cannot entertain any of them now. I must prepare for my trip to Vassalboro on Tuesday, and I must play hostess to the young man who has come to court my daughter. In hindsight, I tell myself that is why I miss the obvious. There is too much happening at once, but I see it, finally, when I lean forward to put the bird in his muse. Ephraim has tied a message around Percy's leg. "I'll meet you at the courthouse. Bring the book." Vassalboro, Wednesday, December 23. I unfold the note, then refold it, as I sit on the bed in my rented attic room at the Silver Street Tavern in Vassalboro. I run my thumbnail along the crease, wearing it thin. Ephraim's handwriting is neat and concise,
perfectly spaced letters drawn with a steady hand. I marvel at their beauty, at the exactness of each elegant line and curve. My husband is numbered among those who believe that a man's handwriting is a testament to his character. The hearing starts in less than an hour, but Ephraim still isn't here. I made the trip alone yesterday, choosing not to travel with the Fosters, so I could have time and space to think, and arrived at sunset, expecting to find my husband waiting for me. He wasn't. So I skipped dinner and went to bed early, eager for a good night's sleep. My stomach rumbles, but the thought of eating makes me nauseous. I put up my hair, pull on my best dress, lace my boots, and tuck the journal into a leather satchel before leaving the room. I descend all three flights of stairs carefully, minding where I set my feet in the dim stairwell. Instead of eating breakfast, I grab a soft, wrinkled apple from a bowl on one of the tables as I pass through the main hall, then take it to the stables behind the tavern where Brutus is housed. It isn't much lighter in there than in the stairwell, and I am forced to dodge piles of manure on my way to his stall. A quick glance in all directions reveals that there is no sign of Sterling. "Where are you?" I mutter under my breath. Brutus whickers when I appear in front of him and sticks his head over the stall door. I hold out the apple on my palm and he picks it off with his teeth. "Don't bite anyone while I'm gone," I say, then rub his nose fondly. I stand there, eyes closed for a moment longer. The smell of hay and horse and manure grounds me. It is a fortifying scent that reminds me of home. "Yes, I'm dawdling," I tell Brutus. "Sometimes a woman has to do a thing she fears." He stares at me, brown eyes unblinking, unsympathetic. Then he snorts, sending a puff of warm air into my face. "Fine, then, be an ass." Unlike Hollowell, all court proceedings in Vassalboro take place at the meeting house, a long rectangular one-story building that serves as church, courthouse, and community center. It sits directly across the street from the tavern, and once I step outside, I see that there is already a line of people waiting to get in. As in The Hook, court days always draw a crowd. Not wanting to lose an advantageous seat, I hustle across the muddy road and up the steps onto the boardwalk that connects all the shops and buildings on that side of the street. I slide in behind a group of whispering women and follow them into the meeting house. Half the benches are already filled, and I maneuver as close to the front as I can. Once I've chosen my spot, I tuck the satchel between my feet and wait, because one of the defendants in the Foster case also happens to be a circuit court judge. This hearing has garnered a great deal of attention. That does not mean that it will be first on the docket, or that it will even be heard today. The Court of General Sessions has been known to run for up to 3 days, though I suspect that won't be the case this session, given that Christmas is looming. I can see Joseph North sitting to the left of a long table at the front of the room, where an older man in silk robes and a powdered white wig studies the docket. Because it is the winter meeting, his robe is red. Black is reserved for summer. North does not look pleased to be seated with the other defendants, and they do not speak to one another or anyone else. He sits ramrod straight, cleanly shaved, and wearing his best coat. The room continues to fill, and there is still no sign of Ephraim. But at precisely 9 o'clock, the judge bangs his gavel on the table, and the room falls silent. I crane my neck to look for Rebecca Foster, and find her in the back corner, sitting beside her husband. Her eyes are closed, and her face is turned toward the window, as though drawing strength from the meager light that filters through. She looks beautiful and broken. Across the aisle and 5 rows forward is Lydia North. She is wan and deflated, thin as a rail, pale as a ghost, cheekbones sharper, clavicles jutting out above the lace collar of her blue dress. I think her headaches must be worse of late,
yet she is not deterred from supporting her husband. "The Court of General Sessions is now open," the clerk announces. "The Honorable Obadiah Wood presiding." Honorable is a term used loosely, in that Wood, a physician, is, like North himself, an untrained justice of the peace, recognized by the state of Massachusetts and the District of Maine, but not a lawyer by trade. He fills a specific gap in the legal system and has a rudimentary understanding of the law at best. Most of these judges rule by common sense, but some by partiality. Because this is only a hearing, there are no lawyers present. There is no jury, and no verdict will be handed down. The court meets simply to ascertain the validity of the accusation and to set formal charges for a future trial, should one be required. Obadiah Wood looks at the docket before him and says, "The court will hear evidence in the case of the Commonwealth versus Henry Jackson. Mr. Jackson, a barber, is accused of malicious injury while shaving Jacob Retton 2 months past." Two men approach the long table and take turns arguing their case, as the judge asks each of them a series of questions. The entire debate takes less than 10 minutes, and Wood declares that Henry Jackson cut his client with a straight razor by accident, and no charges are filed, despite the fact that Jacob Retton will have a scar along his jaw for the rest of his life. Henry Jackson is ordered to pay a fine of 12 shillings and recompense. And so it goes. He hears 3 cases of petty theft, 2 of slander, 1 divorce petition, 1 estate settlement, a breach of contract, said contract being a handshake, and 5 requests for the collection of debt. He orders a total of 6 fines, all of which are recorded by the clerk. It takes nearly 2 hours to clear these cases, and I am starting to feel stiff and numb from sitting so long. I regret not eating breakfast. I am wondering whether there will be an opportunity to slip out and find a privy to relieve myself. "Next on the docket is the Commonwealth versus Joseph North and Joshua Burgess." I tense as North stands. But then Barnabas Lambert slips from his spot at the edge of the room and approaches the table. He'd been so still that I hadn't seen him. He whispers something to Obadiah Wood, then walks back to his seat. Barnabas does see me, however, and I cannot tell whether his expression is one of irritation or curiosity. I doubt he expected to find me here. If there is time afterward, I will apologize for not warning him about the body. Obadiah Wood turns to the clerk and says, "Please strike Joshua Burgess from the court records. We have been notified that he is deceased. Also note that there may be a future inquiry as to cause of death." "I beg your pardon, Your Honor." North takes a step forward and clears his throat. "I believe there has been a mistake. Benjamin Page, a physician in Hollowell, declared Joshua Burgess's death an accidental drowning." I look to North, curious what he's up to. Not 5 days ago, he threatened Cyrus, insinuated that he'd been the one to kill Burgess. And now he's pushing Dr. Page's assessment again. It doesn't make sense. As though sensing my scrutiny, North's eyes flick to mine, tighten, then return to the judge. Oh, it's a threat, I think, to me. He knows I don't want Cyrus's name brought up in court regarding a murder investigation. He's reminding me that he has a card to play.
"Mr. Lambert?" Wood asks.
Barnabas steps forward once more, but removes his hat this time and lays it against his thigh.
"Yes, Your Honor. You went to apprehend Mr. Burgess?"
"I did, on the orders of this court."
"And what did you find?"
"That he is dead. I saw the body myself as it's being stored until the ground thaws enough for burial."
"And did it appear to you that the man had drowned?"
Barnabas shakes his head
and two ringlets fall across his brow.
No, Your Honor. He, North clears his throat. Again, Your Honor, if I may clarify. If I want your clarification, I will ask for it. As you were saying, Mr. Lambert.
I have been curious about Barnabas from the moment I saw him scuffling outside Pollard's Tavern with James Wall, and he continues to surprise me now.
When I found the body of Mr. Burgess, I saw that he had countless injuries, so I asked to see the court records regarding his death. I was obliged by one Henry Sewell of Hollowell.
Here he glances at me and offers a nod so faint I barely catch it.
It is true that the official cause of death recorded is that of drowning.
The crowd murmurs quietly, and Barnabas lets them.
But, he says after a moment, the record also shows that there was a second conflicting opinion as to cause of death, also recorded by a medical professional, that of murder, specifically hanging. In my capacity as an officer of the court, it is my opinion, given that Mr. Burgess is one of two men accused of a serious crime, this seems a matter worth looking into, in no small part because, and here he does look apologetic, during that same hearing, a man was accused of killing Mr. Burgess.
What man? Wood asks.
Reverend Isaac Foster, sir.
Stupid boy, I think. And when Barnabas glances at me, he can safely judge my thoughts by my expression alone, his eyebrows pinched together in concern before he turns back to Wood.
Mr. North, Wood asks, was any proof of this offered to your court?
He stands, and I can see that he is choosing his words carefully.
A young woman who used to work for the Fosters claims that she overheard Mrs. Foster say that her husband killed the man. But that point was also argued in my courtroom. So I had my clerk record the accusation, but took no further action as it seemed to be a concern best left to another court.
North offers a pinched smile.
Given the circumstances. Well, at least we can agree on that, Wood snorts,
then whacks the table with his gavel.
The clerk will note that the question of Joshua Burgess's cause of death remains undecided and will be held over until the next session, as will any consideration of involvement by Reverend Foster or anyone else. We will move forward to the issue at hand. The case against Joseph North as it relates to the accusation of injury to Mistress Foster's person. All parties, please come forward.
Rebecca moves to the front of the room, fingers knotted together at her waist, head held high. Isaac follows, a hand set protectively in the small of her back. She looks at Isaac, alarmed, when he pulls away from her side and approaches the table.
I have a request to make before we begin, he says.
Wood looks at Rebecca, then at Isaac.
I presume you are Mr. Foster? I am. Have no fear, Mr. Foster. The court will not concern itself today with the accusation made against you. That is not what I would like to address. Although, given that neither my wife nor I were in Judge North's court last month, and we did not have the chance to defend ourselves, I would like the record to show that I formally deny the accusation. I had no part in that man's death. Very well, then. The clerk will record your statement.
Isaac Foster is just past 30 and is drifting from plain to homely, yet he still has the voice of an orator and it resonates through the room.
On the same day those scurrilous accusations were made against me, Joseph North filed fornication charges against my wife. I would like them dropped. That is highly unusual, Wood says. Why were charges filed?
Isaac opens his mouth to answer, but North, clearly nervous, interrupts.
Mistress Foster's young housekeeper brought that charge, not me. She claims that Mistress Foster is pregnant by a man not her husband. And would this be the same young woman, no longer in her employ, who also accused her husband of murder? Wood asks.
Ah, he clears his throat. Yes, it would.
There is ice in Obadiah Wood's tone as he asks,
and you thought it appropriate to file these charges in a case in which you are the defendant?
The courtroom is hushed. All eyes turn to the front of the room where this latest twist is unfolding. North lifts his chin.
I thought to do my